Come in. For one who clings, motion exists. For one who does not cling, there is no motion. Where no motion is, there is stillness. Where stillness is, there is no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming nor going. Where no coming or going is, there is neither arising nor passing away. Where neither arising nor passing away is, there is neither this world nor a world beyond nor a state between. This verily is the end of suffering. And by the way, this is a verse in praise of equanimity. Challenge of equanimity, it raises our fear of boredom, endemic in our culture. To be bored is almost like a death of self, something we fear. Equanimity challenges our constructed identities. It raises the fear of being no one, in that our sense so often of who we are is defined exactly as I mentioned by events, by something happening. In truth, our changing sense of who we are is an event that arises and passes in relationship to other events. Selfing is eventing. You hear that? Selfing is eventing. It's an eventing that arises in relationship to other eventings. You know, there's eventing of an emotion, and there is the eventing of a selfing in relationship to that emotion. Sad self, happy self, it's eventing. Selfing is eventing. I will go more into this, by the way. The Buddha, when he got up from the Bodhi tree, said, I gained absolutely nothing from complete unexcelled liberation. And we see how much of our lives revolves actually around something quite different, around getting something, around going somewhere, around events. We imagine no events as this incredibly dull, uninspired, uninteresting life. And we surely don't want to be uninteresting. Now, what I want to look at is actually whether these fears and these challenges are actually true. What is the nature of equanimity? What does it look like as a practice? What is its effect upon our hearts, minds, life? Equanimity is not, again, like metta, not some abstract idealized state, but it is a moment-to-moment application of insight. And there is a path and an application of equanimity, and there is a fruition of equanimity. From the Tibetan, equanimity is translated as being equally near all things. Colloquially, in India, equanimity is used often to mean to see with patience. To see with patience. Upekkha, or equanimity, is sometimes translated to look over, to be a guardian of. At times translated as to stand in the middle of all of this. To stand in the middle of all of this. This sense of poise, of balance. So again, like many of the other paramis, where do we cultivate this sense of balance? Well, in the very places we find ourselves knocked off balance. To understand what is happening in our reactions, our hearts, that lead us to being imbalanced. Now, one dimension of equanimity that is spoken about a lot in the discourses is to teach us how to stand in the middle of what are called the eight worldly winds, the inevitable events in life that are met with optional reactions. Equanimity is a protection from optional reactions. The eight worldly winds, praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, gain and loss. Parts of all events in all of our lives, parts of all of our lives, unavoidable. None of us will ever entirely avoid meeting these winds. They are part of the setup for the loss of balance, but only one half. The other part for that is really at the root of the loss of balance is how we meet those worldly winds. Look at this. How do we meet praise, success, pleasure, gain? Anybody unhappy with these? We meet the pleasant with clinging. Happiness, delight, of course, but too often clinging. Nothing wrong with the happiness, the delight. The clinging piece becomes an issue that knocks us off balance. And we try to armor ourselves against their twins, the difficult. Blame, failure, pain and loss. Again, met with sorrow, understandable. Often met with aversion, resistance, the optional reaction. Now, both the clinging, wherever we find it in our lives, creates agitation. Agitation in our bodies, agitation in our minds. To cling is to live in an agitated state. It's to live in a state of restlessness. And that agitation, born of clinging to the pleasant, avoiding the unpleasant, which is still another form of clinging, means that it gets translated into action. So life becomes a kind of territory, a pattern of pursuing the pleasant when we have it, trying to hold on to it, fearing avoiding the unpleasant. Where it does arrive, doing our best to fix it or get rid of it. And when something is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, often we disappear into dullness or boredom, which becomes a new springboard for craving. It's looking for something to excite us or interest us. Now this whole cycle of running between highs and lows, elation, depression, excitement, boredom, fear and hope, we start to accept it as being quite normal. We just accept it as being quite normal. But its essential effect is that it's exhausting. It's utterly exhausting to spend our life in pursuit and avoidance. And of course, it rests upon this belief that I have mentioned once or twice over this weekend, that the well-being of our heart is always tied to conditions. So the Buddha actually suggested that this life was far from normal. That it's a way of life that undermines well-being. In fact, he defined this kind of life of agitation, pursuit and avoidance as dis-ease. Dis-ease, one of the translations of dukkha. Dis-ease. We can take the hyphen out and it becomes disease. More radically, it suggests that in truth our inner well-being is not at all tied or dependent on these eight worldly winds or conditions. Essence of the Buddha's teaching, the sources of joy and sorrow live in our own hearts and not in the world of conditions. Equanimity is encouraging us to find the inner resources and understanding that allows us to stand in the middle of all of this and to be equally near all things with poise and balance. Now there are supporting factors for equanimity. It's not like equanimity somehow magically appears. We would wish. There are supporting factors. Certainly developing equanimity as all the paramis stands side by side with the development of insight. One of the supporting factors of equanimity is integrity, what the Buddha described as the bliss of blamelessness. The bliss of blamelessness, which is a very close relative of fearlessness. When we live, act, and speak with integrity, we are confident in our conduct. Second supporting factor of equanimity is mindfulness. The more unconscious we are, the more vulnerable we are to being caught by the winds of life and the winds of our own reactivity. I think this is probably pans out in all of our experience. The more unmindful we are, the more vulnerable we are to being caught by the winds of life and reactivity. Again, it is the way in which sati, or mindfulness, protects the mind, allows the mind to be strong, to be grounded, less prone to being lost in thinking, less prone to being lost in reactivity. The Buddha described the unmindful mind like a boat without a rudder, just being tossed about on stormy seas. The third of the supporting factors is the cultivation of ease and contentment. We easily cultivate the patterns of stress and busyness. When we become impatient, it's like volunteering for imbalance. I'm sure you've seen this, that the more wired you are, the more reactive you are. As the Buddha said, in the mind of happiness, attention finds a true foundation, happiness is cultivated. We need to learn how to take the time to stop, appreciate a sunset, enjoy a cup of tea, connect with the lovely, cultivate happiness as a practice. Another of the supporting factors of equanimity is the insight into impermanence. Again, we revisit this one, this most important insight. Knowing that the things change, but in the midst of the worldly winds, we have attacks of amnesia. You know, the pleasant comes along and there's clinging to it. Do we ever have amnesia about impermanence? Often the unpleasant comes along and we cling to it. Oh, this is forever. I will always be like this. Forever and always are the saboteurs of equanimity. What does it mean to actually know that reality of impermanence amidst all the worldly winds? The fifth of the supporting factors of equanimity is acceptance around the first noble truth. The simple acceptance that there is unsatisfactoriness in life. And at times there is pain. To let go of blame, to let go of the story that this shouldn't be happening to me, it's unfair. To find the spaciousness to embrace suffering, lets go of many layers of agitation. The sixth of the qualities, I think, that support equanimity is the cultivation of non-identification, non-self. The second layer of this is me, this is happening to me, this is mine, is surely a big part of knocking us off balance. So equanimity is, in a sense, it's a kind of vigilance of mindfulness. It's a vigilance of attention. It's not a state, it's certainly not indifference, that's the near enemy of equanimity. It is rooted in understanding. It is, so look at the way, so I want to look at some of these places where equanimity appears. First, as a Brahma Vihara, as one of the Brahma Viharas, one of the divine abidings. Certainly, the divine abidings are taught as distinct practices, but they are interwoven. One of the suttas says, love gives to equanimity its boundless nature. Compassion guards equanimity from falling into indifference. Equanimity gives selflessness to love, gives patience, courage, and fearlessness to compassion, and guards appreciative joy from sentimentality. It is running through all of the Brahma Viharas. So I want to look at the place that equanimity plays in the ways that our world is constructed. If we trace any psychological or emotional event or storm back to its beginning, we see it's a process of constructing and building a world. Now, in this process of constructing or building our world of the moment, Vedana, or the basic feeling tones of experience, plays a huge role in the kind of worlds that we construct moment to moment. Vedana is those core textural tones of pleasant, unpleasant, and that which is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, plays such a core role in constructing our worlds. And this is the place where equanimity is most brought to bear. Okay, so let us take, just check out in our experience, all events, all experience, all sense impression, all phenomena carry a Vedana tone of either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. Pleasant nor unpleasant. The sound of the bell, 99% of this is subjective. You know, if I ring the bell and sometimes you're so happy, if your back's aching, it's a pleasant sound. If I ring the bell and you feel like you're on the precipice of liberation, it's an unpleasant sound. 99% of our perceptions and sense impressions, the Vedana tone that we perceive in them, is subjective. You know what? We go through life saying, this is terrible, this is fantastic, this is amazing, this is so awful, this is so ugly. Do you know what? We're just making it up as we go along. This is my world. It's not your world. It's not the world of my neighbor. You know? It's my world that I'm living in. And What I am doing is I am superimposing my perceptual world upon the external reality and assuming it to be the truth and reacting to it. It's a big one, isn't it? Certainly should lead us to question some of our conclusions and assumptions. In Buddhist psychology, there's a tiny percentage of experience that has intrinsic Vedana tones of being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Tiny, tiny percentage of either emotional or sensory experience. The rest of it is mine. Now, if that doesn't lead us to question what is solid and unchanging in this world, nothing will. But it is so important to acknowledge that. Okay, but anyway, go on. Now, if we are mindful, if we are really mindful, we start at least to be able to know and acknowledge the pleasant as pleasant and unpleasant and as unpleasant and that which is in between as being in between. At least we acknowledge. The whole investigation of its subjectivity will come later. But at least let's start by noticing, pleasant sound, pleasant sight, pleasant thought, pleasant body sensation, unpleasant sight, unpleasant sound, unpleasant thought, unpleasant body sensation. And guess what? There's a whole world in between that we don't even acknowledge because we don't notice it. Now, if we are less, and if we're mindful at that point, we know those feeling tones just as they are. If we are not so mindful at that point, we get busy. Because those feeling tones get overtaken by the underlying tendencies. So the unpleasant gets so immediately hijacked by aversion, the pleasant gets so immediately overtaken by craving, and that which is in between gets so overtaken by delusion, we just disappear. Now those are underlying tendencies that are called sankharas. They are reactions to sensory impression, which includes the mind. Those sankharas, those tendencies of aversion, craving, delusion, these are the big ones that keep us busy, keep us agitated, keep our worlds being constructed. This is a really mini teaching on dependent arising, by the way. So this craving aversion, guess what comes next? Clinging. Clinging to what we want. clinging to what we hate, we see our world begin to shrink, begin to be isolated, and we see the fires of craving and aversion. What is nibbana? Cooling the fires. Cooling the fires. Now this happens so quickly, you know, that it can goes around 1,001 times in a single day, which of course is where mindfulness is an ally of equanimity, because it's meant to slow down this process so we can begin to see it. And without mindfulness, don't we just feel like overtaken by these cycles time and time again? It's where we practice equanimity. Mindfulness of Vedana is said to be the weakest link in this whole chain of events. It is the place where we can deconstruct rather than construct. It's a place where we can begin to see things as they actually are, rather than building that subjective world that we begin believe to be true. So we've talked a lot over the days here about craving and aversion, because these are where clinging and grasping and selfing are most evident, aren't they? They have big voices. Craving and aversion have loud voices. And the pleasant and the unpleasant, what we really see is they play, provide such a big ground for selfing. You know, like when we're in contact with something pleasant, whether it's a thought or a nice meal or, you know, a nice person, you know, we feel good about ourselves, you know? We grow. You know, we have some stature. We feel good about ourselves. We're looking for ways to maintain it. Still agitated. With the unpleasant, there's tons of ground for selfing, isn't it? Because we have so much to do there. You know, we have so much to fix, so much to solve, so much to get rid of. You know, I've got such a big job in front of me. There's huge room for selfing. So as I mentioned, selfing is an event that arises in relationship to other events. Now what I want to talk about more is to look at what it means to practice with the middle ground. Sometimes referred to as being neutral, but that's not a good way of seeing it. It's that which is neither distinctly pleasant or distinctly unpleasant. Now, look around the room. There is so much in this room which is neither distinctly pleasant or unpleasant. It's a bench. Anybody got big aversions? Big cravings to take it home? You know, the projection slide on the wall, the color of the walls. I mean, there's so much in this room which is neither distinctly pleasant or unpleasant. Actually, probably more than that which is distinctly pleasant and unpleasant. There's actually more than the inhabiting, more in that middle ground. This is true in our lives. There are many people, situations, sensations, sights that are neither particularly pleasant nor particularly unpleasant. What is our response to them? We just basically don't see them. We basically don't see them. We just skim over them. Why? One of the reasons is because in this middle ground there's so little ground for selfing. I got nothing to do here. Doesn't shape me in any way. There is so little ground for selfing. I find that so interesting. Why? Because there's no eventing in the middle ground. You can really see in the pleasant sight, sound, sensation, there's a sense of event, isn't there? Oh, good. You know, in the unpleasant sight, sound, impression, there's also this sense of event, isn't there? Oh, no. The middle ground? There's no eventing. And so there's so little territory for selfing to start to take root. Me not making anything happen. So two things happen in that middle ground. Two things can happen. One thing that can happen in that middle ground, which actually I would stress again is a big part of our life. You know, we're not always ricocheting between the pleasant and the unpleasant. Spend quite a lot of time in that middle ground. Two things can happen. One is that we can sink into delusion, and which we usually would label as dullness or boredom. We just sink into this sense of nothing happening. Now that becomes a springboard for craving. Very important to see that, that the neutral, the sense of there being something wrong, something missing, becomes a springboard for craving. Nothing is happening, I'm going to make something happen. Nothing's going on, I'm going to find something that's going on. Something's missing here, even something's wrong, because nothing's happening, I'm going to go start looking. So important to see the relationship between the neutral and craving. Something else can happen in the neutral ground. We can start, if we really notice it, that there is a profound relationship between neutral. I'm using the word neutral, by the way, which is not correct, but it takes me so long to say neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Okay, so just have that association. Look at the deepest definition of mindfulness. It's eventlessness. It's non-eventing. The deepest definition of mindfulness in terms of eventlessness is nothing is being seized upon in the flow of experience and made into an event. There is an equality of seeing that flow of experience without anything being isolated, anything being contracted around. There is no eventing. This territory of the ground between the pleasant and the unpleasant can give us a taste of eventlessness, which very much relates back to that verse I was speaking to you about, neither coming nor going, no motion, no here, no there, no towards and away from, an abiding in an unshakable mindfulness. That non-eventing, if we look at it very closely and look under that first association that this is boring or dull, looks like pretty remarkable stillness and peace. I am a huge advocate of practicing in the neutral zone. I think it can give you a taste of something you never find in the for and against zone. Now, both equanimity as one of the Brahma-Viharas, the divine abidings, and equanimity as the fourth jhana, or the fourth absorption, work quite consciously with the neutral. Now, there's a taste of this in the Brahma-Viharas. When we bring metta or compassion or appreciative joy, for example, to the neutral person, it's a very important piece in metta and compassion and appreciative joy practice. Because what is it that makes someone neutral? We have no shared story. We have no shared history. We have no information to build a self and an other on. This is what makes someone neutral. Because in a sense, there is no then, with no shared story and no history, we have no ground for building craving and aversion. We also have no ground for liking or disliking. In a sense, we have no ground for building a sense of self and other. It is why it is so more important in metta and compassion practice. I personally think in terms of metta practice, for example, it is the most selfless, the most non-self part of the entire practice. Because again, think about the Brahma-Viharas. You bring someone to mind who you like or are fond of. Hey, I feel great, you know. I'd like to hold on to this, feel more of this. Bring someone to mind who you dislike or fear. You know, you've got a project. You're going to work this out. You know, it's something to resolve. Think of the neutral person. What have I got to do there? The most selfless part of simply offering a boundless friendliness that has no agenda, no project, no return. This person's never going to know. It is just the pure generosity of metta. It's such an important piece of metta practice. But I think we get a taste of the boundlessness, the unconditionality, not only of metta, but the impartiality of equanimity. So, what does it mean to be equally near in jhana practice, in absorption practice? I don't even know if I put that in it. In jhana practice and absorption practice, equanimity really comes with the cooling of rapture, the cooling of happiness, the cooling of joy and peace, and actually into stillness. And using stillness as the object of attention, neither coming nor going. Again, it is that taste of non-motion, that taste of non-motion. So what does it mean to be equally near all things, including the neutral? It's not a feeling, it's not an emotion. If we take delusion away from the neutral, we see it is a power, it is a glimpse to a very profound peace and equanimity. We get a taste of unshakable balance. Unshakable balance beyond events, a taste of eventlessness, a taste of stillness, a taste of no motion, the utter poise of the mind and heart. And we get a taste of what it feels like to blow out the fires. And that coolness of blowing out the fires is really describing a quality of aliveness, of richness, but where craving and aversion and delusion has simply disappeared. Now this interchangeable nature of equanimity in nibbana, not regarded as a state, but as an understanding. It is an understanding that essentially is meant to change the shape of our lives. I really rushed through that. I want to come back and read you this verse again of Upekkha. I mean, this comes in Brahma, in the Brahma divine abiding practice of equanimity. This life is but a play of joy and sorrow. May we remain undisturbed by life's rise and fall. I care for you, I care deeply for you, but you are the owner of your actions and their fruit, and I sadly cannot keep you from distress. I think the place for many people on a more relative level where it becomes most challenging to practice equanimity in relationship to those that they most care about. When we see people that we love and care for suffering or ill or engaging in courses of action that we know will lead to tremendous suffering. And so often in those moments and relationships, we find ourselves wanting to rescue people. We want to save them. And part of us knows that we can't. And part of us knows that we can't. And I think what is so important about these particular phrases, first, it is the recognition of how much we are not in control of conditions in this life. There is rise and fall, a play of joy and sorrow. What does us it mean for us to stand in the middle of all of this? Equanimity recognizes that we can care so deeply. This is the compassion part. That we can care so deeply, not only for those that we love, but for the whole world of suffering and pain. But we recognize that it is not within our power to change the heart and mind of another. that we recognize that we are the owners of our acts and their consequences, and so too are all being. We can care, we can offer everything that we can possibly offer, and yet still within an individual's own heart and mind, they will act, they will move, they will make choices. It doesn't stop us caring, but it means there are limits to how much we can rescue. And sadly, I cannot keep you from distress. But it's sad that I cannot keep you from distress. It's not indifferent. It is sad. Okay. That is all I actually have to say, but I'm quite happy that we spend a few minutes, yes, with...
You know, Rodney has talked about equanimity, and he kind of has a problem with that word, he said. And he thinks it's more like, kind of like you were saying, like kind of a stripping away, and then you're left with equanimity. So it's not like a state that you strive for. Can you speak to that?
Well, it is an understanding. I mean, certainly, you know, when you look at equanimity, for example, in the absorption practices, in jhana practice, it is a state, okay? It is an experience. But the state and the experience, for example, in absorption practice, is only meaningful if there is some insight into that state that is then carried into our lives. Because it is really a taste of what is there when all, you know, highs and lows and all the pleasure and the joy is taken away. What is the nature of that stillness? So as a jhana, you know, as an absorption state, like all the absorption states, it's only meaningful if it actually provides some insight that is carried forth into our lives. In terms of one of the Brahma Viharas, equanimity, I don't think of any of the Brahma Viharas as being states. I think of them as being transformations of heart that are really rooted in insight, you know, rather than just some equanimous state that is dependent on conditions and then going to change. You know, that's of so little value, except that if it provides some greater insight again. But I prefer, actually, I mean, I actually don't mind the word upekkha. Sometimes I prefer the Pali because I think the English has too many associations for us. But equanimity for me is, you know, I constantly refer back to how much the Buddha uses equanimity as cooling the fires. Cooling the fires as nibbana, as liberation. But like all the Brahma Viharas, it is both a path and a fruition. You know, so equanimity, that sense of poise, that sense of stillness amidst movement, stillness amidst motion, is something that is really practiced in our life. And we have so many opportunities to practice it in terms of the worldly winds, you know, in terms of changing conditions. We have so many opportunities to practice what it means to stand in the middle of this. Not immune, not indifferent, fully responsive, but knowing in the stripping away of craving and aversion, there is a stripping away of clinging, that is stripping away craving, aversion, and clinging, there is a stripping away of selfing, and what is left is that capacity for stillness. And a huge responsiveness. You know, in terms of the paramis, equanimity is almost the forerunner of our capacity to respond with compassion. I'm not quite sure what you're referring to.
The pattern, the position.
Mm-hmm. path and fruition? I mean, I had a few little subtexts in here. You know, as a Brahma Vihara practice, as a concentration practice, as an insight practice. Listen, it's on going to be online. Come on. Yeah.
Most of the time when I've tried looking at Vedana states, I've gotten really confused because it seems like I'm looking at one sensation and it seems like I'm seeing it being both positive and both pleasant and unpleasant. Not like, and I'm wondering what's going on there, whether I'm like flickering back and forth faster than I realize or whether I'm just kind of confused as to what I'm looking at.
I think there are times when Vedana tones can coexist in a particular sense impression. But there are also times when, like, one Vedana tone will kind of morph into another one. The same Vedana tone, which actually is giving us some indications of our subjectivity around it. And, I mean, all I could suggest is just, you know, do the best that you can to make, you know, first of all, there's the really obvious pleasant and unpleasant. If I scraped my fingernails down and chalkboard, most people would not think of it as pleasant. You know, I mean, look at the really evident ones where there's a real clear sense of the Vedana tone. Then really use that, because it's such a wonderful contemplation, Vedana. I can't think of one that's more important. Then perhaps I would just say stay with it. Just stay with it. Don't think too much about it, that's all. Don't try and figure it out, you know, because, you know, sense impressions are changing so quickly within the field of consciousness that, you know, if we spend too long trying to figure one out, you know, there's 50 others that have happened. So try not to think too much about it. Just try just to have that background intention to notice the Vedana tone. To notice the Vedana tone. And the more that you practice with that, the more evident it becomes. But if it's not clear, I would say don't linger with that, trying to figure it out. Because by that time, you're bound to have had, you know, 20 or 30 more sense impressions. You know, so just don't try too hard to figure it. Yes, sir. Doesn't stay neutral.
No, it doesn't. So what? I'm trying to understand the richness of it.
It has a lot of insight within it, including the fact that it doesn't stay neutral.
Right.
Including the fact that nothing stays neutral. Why doesn't anything stay neutral? Because the nature of mindfulness has a pleasant Vedana tone.
Yes. So just
you're in an equanimous state.
Equanimous state.
Is there the possibility of joy? I
mean, of course. Of course. It's simply, equanimity is simply the removal of craving, aversion, clinging, and selfing. That's also, that's what falls away within equanimity. I mean, there's quite actually a bit else. It's a delusion and ignorance and all other kinds of things fall away. But it is simply that uprooting of craving, aversion, delusion, selfing, clinging. Then the world opens. The world opens. There would be sadness, but not knocked off balance. There would be joy, but not knocked off balance.
said something that I've never heard before. Another thing that you just said in response. So I wanted to ask, you said the nature of mindfulness has a pleasant vagueness.
Yeah.
And you responding to that as to one of the reasons why there was shifting.
Why nothing stays neutral?
I couldn't.
Why nothing stays neutral?
Why nothing stays neutral. And does that have any relationship to...
But there's a big piece of insight in that. In the sense that, you know, that how much the source of joy is in our own hearts. In how much, you know, that our perceptions are constantly playing tricks on us, saying, you know, this is really pleasant and that's really unpleasant, actually. If the neutral changes through mindfulness, what happens to that which surrounds the pleasant and the unpleasant? What happens to the pleasant and the unpleasant in the light of mindfulness? This big piece here. It's huge. And when I talk about practicing with the neutral zone, it is because in stripping away all the underlying tendencies of craving, aversion, and delusion, we strip away arising and passing, we strip away events, and actually there is stillness. And it's going very much back to that verse that I read you about equanimity.
I was just going to ask, so this is somewhat equated with equanimity.
Yes.
The positive vagueness on mindfulness.
It's not that it's positive, it's just that mindfulness brings the world to life. Yeah. And, you know, it's not positive, it is simply aliveness is aliveness. Mm-hmm. It's even inadequate to call it pleasant. Aliveness. It is a little bit like William Blake said, his poem, he says, when the doors of perception are cleansed, the world would appear as it is, infinite. That might be a good line to stop with. Sorry, no, it's okay, go ahead. That's interesting, yeah.
No question about what
yep.
you do,
yep.
And you're suddenly calm.
Yep. That surprises some people. That, you know, they find themselves in the midst of crisis and they suddenly discover this capacity to stand in the middle of this. And it's almost because, like, there's no choice. And maybe we delude ourselves in thinking there's choices in other moments. You know? Maybe we're always in the middle of an emergency. You know, maybe life is an emergency that we're in the middle of. We just haven't recognized it. Yeah, that really surprises some people. And it really shows back to that part of the Buddhist teaching. He says, you know, these seeds live within our consciousness. Just don't let them be accidents.